She was the grieving daughter who played piano tributes on TikTok, the soft-spoken Georgia teen who delivered a tearful eulogy for the parents she'd allegedly just murdered. But behind the piano, behind the tears, behind the viral sympathy, was a truth too twisted for headlines. Sarah Grace Patrick didn't just pull the trigger. She pulled apart a Southern legacy of secrets, hidden ledgers, offshore accounts, and a home soaked in silence. In this three-part, first-person confessional, you'll step into the chilling mind of a girl who says she didn't kill for revenge. She killed for survival. Grace in the Shadows, the Sarah Patrick case, is not just another murder tale. It's a raw, unsettling descent into the layers of curated grief, weaponized silence, and chilling truths buried in polite Southern towns. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted chapter. Chapter 1. The Perfect Daughter. I used to believe there was a version of me that only existed online. The smiling girl with the sea glass eyes and soft Georgia accent, whispering grief-soaked Bible verses over piano covers on TikTok. That girl knew how to cry pretty, how to speak in slow, shaky cadences that could get 100,000 strangers to comment, "Praying for you, angel." But let me tell you something those people never knew. I rehearsed those tears. Like everything else in my life, the grief was curated. The pain, carefully edited. Because before I pulled the trigger, I learned how to perform pain, long before I ever caused it. And if you think you know my story from headlines or hashtags, Georgia teen murders parents, Carrollton double homicide, Sarah Grace TikTok killer, you don't know anything at all. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted chapter. Part 1. Sweet Tea and Secrets. I was born in Carrollton, Georgia. Population, small enough that people still bring casseroles when someone dies, and big enough that nobody asks too many questions if the girl next door starts acting a little off. I had the kind of childhood that looked good on paper. Church on Sundays, cheerleading in the fall, piano lessons after school in a studio that always smelled like lemon pledge and damp wood. But behind the music was something else, something darker, something I never posted about. They say home is where the heart is. But in my house, home was where secrets were buried, not shared. And my stepfather, Charles, Mr. Patrick to most, was the one holding the shovel. He married my mum when I was 12, and from the outside, it was a Southern fairy tale. He was tall, clean-cut, always in pressed shirts and polished boots, owned a small financial consulting business, coached youth baseball, and taught Sunday school. But Charles had a temper that didn't show up in Christmas cards. And my mom. She was the kind of woman who believed obedience was a virtue, and silence was survival. She taught me to keep my back straight, my tone light, and my smile brighter than any bruise. And I was obedient. For a while. Part 2. Piano Keys and Ledgers. I used to lose myself in music. It was the only place where I didn't have to pretend. Mrs. Kellner, my piano teacher, once told me I played like someone who'd seen too much for 17. I just smiled and kept pressing the keys, pretending I didn't hear Charles screaming in my memory, or my mother crying through the walls at night. But something changed the week I turned 17. I'd gone into Charles's home office to print an essay for English class. He never let me in there, but the printer was jammed. When I opened the drawer looking for paper, I saw it. A leather-bound ledger, embossed in gold. It wasn't the kind of ledger you buy at Office Depot. This was old school, heavy, carefully curated, and inside it were names I didn't recognize, numbers I couldn't make sense of, offshore accounts, wiring instructions, an account in Belize labeled SGP-Future. I didn't understand it at the time, but I knew it was bad. It felt like finding blood in the bathtub before the body. I closed the drawer. Didn't say a word. But that night at dinner, Charles stared at me too long, asked me questions he already knew the answers to. And when Mom went to clear the plates, he leaned in and whispered, "Curiosity can be dangerous, Sarah Grace. especially for pretty little girls who don't know how to mind their business. Part 3. TikTok Tears. The first time I made a TikTok about grief, my parents weren't even dead yet. I posted a video of me playing The Sound of Silence on piano, tears in my eyes, with the caption, "Some of us grieve the living too." It blew up. 300,000 views overnight. Comments flooded in. "Stay strong. You're so brave." "Sending love from Michigan." That video wasn't for the algorithm. It was a warning, a quiet scream, and no one heard it. I started posting more vague, emotionally loaded clips about control, fear, being trapped. To everyone else, it looked like poetic oversharing. But to me, it was a countdown. Part 4, February 14th, 2025. Valentine's Day. They were arguing again, louder than usual. I was in my room, headphones in, pretending to study, when I heard my name. "She knows, Charles. She's not stupid. She's not your little puppet anymore." And then I heard something break. I don't remember grabbing the gun. I don't remember how my hands stopped shaking long enough to unlock the safe. I remember only this: my mother's eyes when she turned toward me, and Charles's last words, "You wouldn't dare." I did. Twice. Once for him. Once for her. Part 5. Funeral flowers and false memories. The funeral was 3 days later. I wore white. People said I looked angelic. They hugged me, cried with me, called me brave. I stood at the altar and delivered a eulogy that made women sob and men lower their heads. I told stories about Sunday pancakes and bedtime lullabies. I quoted scripture. I thanked Charles for stepping in when he didn't have to. And all the while, their blood was still under my fingernails. I kept posting, each TikTok more emotional than the last. I lip-synced Bible verses. I played piano tributes. I wrote captions like, "When the people who raised you are the ones who broke you." I messaged true crime influencers, anonymous accounts. I watched myself trend, and I waited. Part 6. The ice cream shop. 5 months later, July 4th, I walked into a Baskin-Robbins in downtown Carrollton, ordered 2 scoops of Rocky Road, sat at a corner table, and called 911. "My name is Sarah Grace Patrick. I'm the one you've been looking for." They arrested me without incident, said I looked relieved. Closing scene. Now I sit here, in an echoey concrete room with no windows. They say I'll be tried as an adult, that the jury will see right through me. Maybe they will. But maybe, just maybe, they'll listen. To the girl behind the TikToks, to the pain beneath the piano, to the story no one wanted to believe, that sometimes the killer is also the victim. And sometimes murder is the only way out of a house where screams from the basement are never answered. Chapter 2. The Girl Behind the Glass. You ever stare at yourself through bulletproof glass? I mean really stare, so hard that your reflection stops looking like you. That was me, 5 days after the confession, in a holding cell with walls painted the color of old teeth and a flickering fluorescent light that buzzed like it had a secret to tell. They moved me to a juvenile wing, temporarily. I was 17, technically still a child. But nothing about the way the officers looked at me felt juvenile. Their eyes didn't say, "Poor girl." Their eyes said, "Monster." I'd been called a lot of things by then, online and off. Teen killer. Psychopath in pearls. The TikTok girl who shot her parents. But what no one seemed to ask was, why? So let me tell you, before the court scripts the rest of this. Part 1. The interrogation room. They say you're innocent until proven guilty. But the moment Detective Malin walked in, I could tell I'd already lost the benefit of the doubt. He had that worn-out Atlanta cop look, cheap tie, thick folder, and eyes that had seen too much. The kind of guy who doesn't just investigate financial crimes, he dismantles lives. "Sarah Grace," he said slowly, like I was a child or a liar, or both. "You want to tell me again why you waited 5 months to come forward?" I didn't flinch. I'd been rehearsing that question since February. I wanted to see if anyone noticed something was wrong, I said. They didn't. He chuckled, low, skeptical. So what? This was a social experiment. You kill your parents and then test the nation's empathy on TikTok? I wanted to scream. But I didn't. Instead, I said, You don't understand the kind of house I lived in. His pen paused over the folder. Help me understand. So I told him everything. Part 2. The Room with Two Doors. There's something you should know about the house on Willow Lane. It had two doors in the basement, one for the wine cellar, and one I wasn't allowed to open. Charles kept it locked. Always. He told people it was for security, that it led to a panic room. But I knew better. The few times I stood outside it, I'd hear things. Low voices, clinking glass, a mechanical humming sound. And once, around Christmas, I peeked inside after he forgot to lock it. What I saw? A wall of safe boxes, stacks of cash, 3 hard drives, and a framed photo of me and Mom, from before he married her. Beside it sat a worn copy of The Art of War, bookmarked with a sticky note. Control is not control unless it's invisible. That night, Charles made me kneel on the tile floor for 3 hours, reciting proverbs about obedience. He never hit me. Not with fists. But his words. His control. It was its own kind of violence. Part 3. The Rabbit Hole. Detective Marlin flipped through photos from the crime scene. You shot your mother in the chest, close range. Why her? That question still haunts me. Not because I don't know the answer, but because I do. She knew. About the accounts, the safe, the offshore shell companies listed under names like Carver's Estate Holdings and SGP Future. She knew. And she stayed. Worse, she told me to pretend I hadn't seen anything. Told me Charles was protecting our legacy. She said I didn't understand the wealth shielding, the bureaucratic red tape, the kind of men who get away with things because they're careful. She said I was just a girl. She said obedience would keep me safe. So yes, I shot her. Because complicity isn't safety. And silence doesn't buy salvation. It buys graves. Part 4. Viral Confessions. The morning after my arrest, I went viral again. Clips of my piano tributes were stitched with headlines like TikTok Star Secretly Killer, The Sarah Grace Deception, Grief as Performance Art. True crime influencers, people I used to message, suddenly acted like they'd always known, like they had unraveled my secrets through digital breadcrumbs, like they were Sherlocks in ring lights. No one saw what I really posted. The subtle messages, the Easter eggs, the screams from the basement masked in minor chords. My entire TikTok was a trail of carefully curated desperation, but people only listen when blood's involved. And now the same audience that once called me an angel was begging to see my mugshot. Part 5. The Accounts. Marlin wasn't stupid. By day 4, he stopped asking about my parents and started asking about the money. Turns out Charles wasn't just a financial consultant. He was a gatekeeper for quiet corruption. Hidden ledgers. Offshore accounts in the Caymans. Real estate trusts under shell corporations. He used words like charitable pass-through and international liquidity shielding. In layman's terms, he moved dirty money for clean people. Judges, politicians, developers. People who knew how to make things disappear, including girls like me. The ledger I found was just one of 3, and the one labeled SGP-Future. That account had nearly $480,000 in my name. But I never touched a dime. Part 6. The Offer. A week into my confinement, a lawyer showed up. Expensive suit, no smile, no empathy. Said he was here on behalf of interested parties. Offered me a deal. Plead guilty to second-degree murder. Claim abuse. Seal the ledgers. Never speak of the accounts again. In exchange? 10 years. Juvenile time. transfer after 21, an easy path out for a killer. But here's the thing, they didn't want justice. They wanted silence, and silence is what got us here in the first place. So I declined, and 2 days later, my story disappeared from mainstream headlines, as if a 17-year-old girl killing her parents had simply become boring. Closing moment. I sleep better now, not because I'm free, I'm not, but because the worst secrets are finally out. This cell, these cinderblock walls, feel more honest than my childhood home ever did. I used to think truth was a weapon, but maybe it's a mirror, and when you finally break it, you stop seeing who they wanted you to be, and start seeing who you are, even if the reflection is cracked, even if the girl behind the glass doesn't smile back. Chapter 3. The Trial of Silence. You ever notice how courtrooms are always cold? Not just the AC. They're cold in feeling. Like the walls themselves are trained not to care. Like the floors have absorbed too many pleas, too many lies, and no longer react. On the first day of my trial, I walked into that room in handcuffs. 17 years old. Hair tied back. No makeup. They told me to look remorseful. But the truth is, I wasn't sorry in the way they wanted me to be. I wasn't sorry my stepfather was gone. I wasn't sorry the house on Willow Lane was finally quiet. I was only sorry that no one had listened before the blood. Part 1. The Southern Spectacle. The trial was held in Carroll County Superior Court. The gallery was packed. True crime podcasters, TikTok journalists, Southern mothers in pearls clutching tissue, ex-pastors whispering prayers. The judge wore a face that hadn't smiled since Clinton was in office. My lawyer, a public defender named Faye Collins, was sharp but tired. She reminded me of Mrs. Kellner from piano class. Always calm, always watching. The prosecution painted me as a calculating teen. This wasn't a crime of passion, they said. It was an execution disguised as grief, a curated tragedy by a girl obsessed with the spotlight. They played my TikToks like they were crime scene photos, paused at my tears, rewound my piano tributes, treated every caption like a confession. They said I manipulated the world, but no one asked why a child needed to. Part 2. The Psychologist. They brought in a forensic psychologist, a man with kind eyes and a neutral tone. He testified that I exhibited signs of reactive dissociation and learned helplessness. He said I wasn't insane, just conditioned. Her mother normalized financial abuse and emotional manipulation. Her stepfather enforced compliance through psychological warfare, not violence. But the damage is no less real. The jury shifted uncomfortably. They wanted bruises. They wanted a scar to point to. But the wounds I carried, they were internal. And invisible never makes for compelling evidence. Part 3. The Ledgers. And then came the bombshell. On day 6, my lawyer did what no one expected. She introduced the ledgers. 3 volumes, black leather, presented in clear plastic sleeves. The courtroom went still. Inside were names. Not just Charles Patrick. Not just shell companies. But donors. Judges. Community figures. One entry read, $75,000 wired to Reverend Charles Landry, pre-trial campaign hush. Another, SGP Trust, offshore transfer to Carver's estate, July 2024. They weren't just hiding money, they were hiding me. Suddenly the trial wasn't about murder anymore, it was about power. And what happens when a girl dares to break the chain? The courtroom erupted in whispers. The judge called a recess. Outside, the reporters flipped. Ledger leak shocks Georgia courtroom. Carrollton case exposes Southern secrets. Teen killer or whistleblower? Part 4. Mother interrupted. The prosecution scrambled. They tried to shift the focus. Back to my mom. They showed family photos. Played a voicemail of her singing Amazing Grace. They said, whatever Charles did, Margaret was an innocent. But innocence isn't silent in the face of evil. She was a mother. She should have protected me. Instead, She protected wealth, prestige, reputation. I didn't kill her for being cruel. I killed her for choosing him again and again, until there was no one left to choose me. Part 5. The Verdict. On day 9, the jury deliberated for 10 hours. I sat in a corner of my cell, staring at the wall. No music, no social media, no comments to read. Just me. And the truth. When they brought me back in, I didn't look at the gallery. I looked at the judge, because no matter what the jury said, he would decide my fate. The foreman stood, hands shaking. "We, the jury, find the defendant, Sarah Grace Patrick, guilty of manslaughter in the second degree." Gasps. No murder charge, no life sentence. Just 12 years, with possibility of parole in 6. The courtroom exploded, half in fury, half in relief. But I didn't cry, because for the first time in my life, someone believed me enough not to kill me with disbelief. Part 6. Final Reflections. Now I sit in a correctional facility outside Atlanta. They moved me from juvenile to adult custody on my 18th birthday. No piano, no TikTok, just concrete, steel, routine. But I'm still telling my story, even now, especially now. Because you can bury bodies, you can burn ledgers, but truth has a pulse. And if you listen close enough, you can still hear it echo like screams from the basement. Only now I don't flinch when I hear them, because the girl who used to whisper Bible verses for likes, she's gone. In her place stands someone else. Not a victim. Not a killer. Just a girl who chose not to be silent anymore. And that, my dear listener, is the most dangerous thing of all.